Yo, yo, before this episode gets going, just a friendly reminder that the DJ Mag Top 100 voting has opened. Last year, you guys voted us in at number 77, and we could not thank you enough, but we need your support again this year. So if you think we deserve it, we're going to put the link in the description of this episode. Head over there, vote Breathe Carolina as your number one artist, and we will be in your debt forever. So yeah, with that said, enjoy the show and vote Breathe Carolina. We love you guys. Thank you. Goodbye.
Guess so, guess so, guess so, guess. Guess so, guess so, guess so, guess.
All right, welcome to the OES podcast. Today on the show, we got our friend, Chris Voitel. He is the VP of A&R at Epitaph Records. Chris.
What's up, baby?
How you doing?
Good, man. How you guys doing?
Good,
man. We're chilling.
How's your day going so far? Like, what have you done so far today? It's pretty early in the day still, so you probably haven't done, or maybe you've done a ton.
Well,
I don't know.
I kind of get started early these days.
He's like, I've already done millions of things.
Yeah, I mean, with a six-week-old, sleep is pretty erratic. So, today, we've got a handful of new artists that are joining the label, and so I've been booking some production for them. Just a lot of conference calls, getting stuff lined up, and then we've got a release from one of our artists, Honey, coming out on Friday. So they're doing Amoeba in store later today. So it's gonna be a busy one.
What do you do as an A&R for people like don't know, because we haven't had an A&R on here.
Oh.
What do you do like on a I guess you probably wear a ton of hats, but like what is like, you know, the whole point of like what you guys do?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different like facets of it, I guess you could say. The most important one is discovering and signing new talent. And I'd say, you know, with in the current landscape with Spotify and just streaming in general, there's so much more music to listen to, unsigned music to listen to, you know? So a lot of my day is spent kind of combing through that. But then once, you know, for me, when I came onto the label, I also inherited a lot of stuff that was already signed. So there's the discovery element, but then there's also like kind of managing the already signed acts. Not managing like an artist manager would, but like managing
music
in our process. Yeah. So like as you and I did together at Fearless, it's like, all right, when it comes time to make a new record for an artist, it's like you take into account the style of music and the direction they want to take it in, the time frame, and then the budget, you know, and those taking those things into consideration, we brainstorm ideas from different producers to work with. And then from there, kind of hone in on who we want to hire. And then from there, it depends. Some bands want a lot of hands-on help. A&R. Some bands, you know, just kind of want to do it more themselves.
Are you seeing that a lot more now? Because we talk about it all the time, how like now, as opposed to like when I first met you when I was like 10, but like when you got into the game versus like now, I feel like bands are so much more, or most bands or artists are so much more DIY than they used to be. Are you seeing that a lot more now? Like bands are just a lot more hands-on?
Yeah, well, I think it's because of technology and the ability to make music on laptops with software that's accessible to like a lot more people, you know, than it used to be. So that has kind of what's the word? It's turned into like this whole new wave of like young producers and a lot of bands that have come to us that we've signed in the last couple of years already have a body of music, whether it was like recorded DIY and then someone of more note that mixed it or whatever kind of hodgepodge combination, you know, it's good stuff, right? And so what we've done is like sign the band and licensed or purchased those existing recordings as kind of the first phase, you know? And then while we work on new music, we can kind of incorporate the existing stuff into our system, promote it, market it.
I feel like it's a lot cooler, like, because back in the day, it was like, yeah, we're going to send you this like shitty demo and like hopefully get it.
I was just going to say, like, it has to be so much different now, because it's like back in the day, like, you would just get sent like boxes of demos, I would imagine. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, yeah, you have to go through and listen. Now it's like, I'm sure you guys still get a shitload of demos, right?
Yeah, but they come in the form of SoundCloud links.
Yeah, SoundCloud. And so like you can like now you have to like scan through Spotify. You have to scan through SoundCloud. You have to scan through like the actual demos that are coming in. Like it feels like, how is that process like going through and choosing after like a full day of listening to music? Like how do you decipher? You know what
it's
I mean?
It's overwhelming, man.
I can imagine.
Extremely overwhelming. And what we do is we use Asana, which is like one, it's like a software-based program.
Oh, I thought you meant like a, he's like, we sit in the sauna and just day.
Jam.
We just listen to tunes.
That would be sick. No, I mean, it basically what it allows us to do is organize everything. So, you know, my boss and a few other people that are involved in the A&R department, we basically can dump all of our prospects, if you will, into this page, into this workspace. And then from there, there's different tags. So it's a way of organizing the kind of chaos that is all the new music.
Yeah.
I'll be frank. There's a lot of stuff that gets sent to me just by people who I don't know. And it's pretty hard to get to.
Yeah.
I would imagine, though, because it's like you guys are getting so much. I mean, you're getting music from bands that are already signed. You're getting music from managers who you guys do know. And then like it's got to be, I feel like I wouldn't even know. At the end of the day, it's like, I don't even know if this is good. Like, I really don't know. I've listened to so much music.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons why we'll continue to like click on those unsolicited links is because you never know.
Have you signed a band in your career that like was like a unsolicited, like I just clicked on it and it was like that good?
So early on when I was at Epic in like 2004, that's when people would still send, I would get the piles of CDs that David was talking about. And there was one that was a band called Quiet Drive that we ended up signing. But that was, 15 years ago.
Yeah,
like recently, great. There hasn't been anything that I just randomly stumbled on that we ended up signing. But I know people that do A&R that have had that happen to.
Yeah.
When you guys are combing through like demos and stuff, like not demos but songs, like what do you look for? Do you go and look at like the full artist profile, like and see how many, like what their engagement's like or what their this or that, or do you just purely like, if you love the song, you're like, all right, let's go for it. Like, what do you look for?
I think like the first step is really connecting with the music and the song itself. But yeah, I mean, with the way that you can just instantly look at someone's Spotify and see the engagement, it's pretty hard to not go, I mean, and it's interesting you bring that up because there has been times where I heard something, I thought it was really cool. You know, I wasn't like completely sold, but I thought it was cool. And the engagement can push me one way and can push me in one direction or the other.
Yeah. And when do you mean like just on Spotify, or are you guys looking at like Instagram? Are you looking at,
well, what we use something called Music Connect, which is like the same thing. It's like the new version of Nielsen SoundScan, but for the digital age.
Oh, cool. Oh,
okay. So it's something that we pay for, it's like a metrics, database, but essentially I'll type in whatever it is, the Monsters or something. And then it'll break down all of the weekly and to date streams from YouTube, Spotify, Apple. Cause obviously Apple doesn't share their analytics.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I heard they're going to start doing it, or I don't know if that's like true. I read a thing and I was like, Apple finally going to start sharing analytics.
That'd be awesome if they did. But yeah, I mean, again, I was going to say for better or for worse, but I mean, it's just kind of the state of where we're at. Like that will push me. If it's something that I'm like, oh, this is really cool, I'm still on the fence.
You need the one last.
Yeah. And then I see like, oh my gosh, but it's getting, they've got a couple hundred thousand monthly listeners and like you can see it trending like, in an upwards fashion, then chances are we'll be like, okay, let's take a serious look. If we're on the fence and it's like, there's 100 monthly listeners,
it's hard. I feel like back in the day, it was like MySpace. It was like, we're on the fence about this band, but they're in the top five unsigned bands. Well, people like it.
There's so much music that it's like you almost need that like that extra confident boost of like other people loving it too. You know what I mean? Like you can't I can't just sign this band. They have like 20 followers on Instagram and 5 streams, but I love this song. It just like doesn't make sense. You know what I mean?
And you're also in such a hard position because like I couldn't do it because you have to be so open-ended, right? It's like not just your opinion. It has to be like, I might not even like this, but I know it's either going to sell or other people will like it. It's such a weird position to be in where it's like you have to probably sign stuff all the time that maybe you don't personally like, you wouldn't listen to, but you can like see it connecting with other people.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the first part about, not being so kind of stubborn to think that like I know what the kids are gonna like, I know what the fans are gonna like, and yeah. I'm gonna disregard, you know, what the fans are already saying, you know,
right.
In that, even if it's in a small capacity, like streaming and social media has kind of allowed that first part of the process to be done for us a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, that first test, that first reaction, you know, to the music from the fans. But yeah, I mean, I definitely consider myself, you know, like a song guy and someone that's like spent enough time doing this that I can differentiate a good song from a bad song. But there's also, you know, with a lot of, with a lot of like hip hop and rap stuff, I mean, it's been this way for a long time, but there's not as much of a melodic hook in a lot of those types of songs. I mean, you'll have a melodic hook in the beat, but it's really about the lyrics.
You know?
And I think you're seeing that again with this whole kind of new wave of SoundCloud rap, emo rap, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So that's been interesting because there's songs that are getting millions and millions of streams that don't have that more obvious like hook.
Yeah, it's not a pop structure. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's 2 minutes long.
I haven't been able to get it. He shows me stuff all the time. I'm just like,
Well, people are just diving and they're diving so much into like the person as well. You know what I mean? It's like these rappers that just like have tattoos in their face and dreads. It's like there's these like, you know, this new wave of like scene kids that are now pushed towards like the SoundCloud rappers. And it is so the songs are 2 minutes long. The production's horrible. But they have 5 million streams. You're like, what the hell?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, it's interesting if you kind of look at like history, like when like punk, and I'm not talking about like pop punk, but like when like the more like original like punk and hardcore, like Minor Threat, Fugazi, all that stuff, like there wasn't any melody there. It was all about them as figures.
Yeah.
You know, them as, it was about their lyrics and their words. And I think that's what you're seeing with a lot of this stuff now.
Yeah, it's crazy how it's come like back around. Like it's so weird.
I mean, and the melodies have come back around. A lot of those melodies, I'm just like, you were singing those melodies 10 years ago. Like it literally sounds like old scene music, but it's like over rap like beats now. It's a crazy. We had Jordan from the Ready Set on here, and I was like, sounds like a Ready Set song from 10 years ago. It really does. It's exactly the same.
It does, man. I mean, I had this conversation with someone the other day, but you know, even early Breathe Carolina stuff and Broken Side. And then on the popier side, yeah, Ready Set.
I mean, Forever Broken Side, kids. Literally, we're like, I don't like their music, but it was ahead of the curve because it sounds exactly like some of the stuff that's like huge now, which is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, taking those like that song Numb by Horsehead, which is considered by a lot of these guys like kind of like the Smells Like Teen Spirit of the SoundCloud rap generation. It's a Silverstein song sample, you know, over a trap beat. Yeah.
I didn't even know that. That's crazy.
Yeah. Like when I talk to these kids who are, you know, anywhere from like 18 to 22 on average, like they all, it makes sense for Epitaph to get involved in this because they all came up loving skate punk or loving From First to Last and Blink 182. It's super interesting, you know, like culturally you go to the shows and it's like the same as it was like in early Breathe Carolina days with like the camaraderie there between every band on the bill, except for they all just feature on each other's songs. And it's just like a freaking chaotic.
We say it a lot, how like, I think that was a big, I mean, not the downfall of the scene, but like it was a big downfall in the scene where I'm like, the bands didn't help each other enough, like musically, you know, like I feel like, you know, if the Kellens and the Vicks and like all the guys that were big and like obviously like Kellen and Vic did a song together, but like had they all been doing songs with each other and like just, you know, like the way rappers do, I feel like the scene could have sustained in an upward trajectory for a longer time because it would have built like even more of a community like amongst the bands. I think huge. But they for some reason.
Interesting how that works. So how did you get into A&Ring? When was it
what is
like
the story? Because I met you.
Yeah, give us a quick backstory.
I think it was called Lindero. That is the earliest memory I have of you. So how did you go from like what's your story like to now?
So I got an internship at Epic Records in 2002. So before that, you know, I was always into music since I was a kid. Played in a bunch of like, you know, mediocre punk and ska and heart, whatever the current trend was, you know, kind of over the years. And then the last band I was in, Lindero, was playing a lot in LA, and I was friends with a lot of other LA bands, and it was just kind of in that mix, you know. That's when like the Sunset Strip was kind of like still,
yeah, it was tight.
Like in full effect, where you'd bounce around from the Viper Room to the Roxy to the Whiskey to the Troubadour.
Yeah,
like, you know, that was just kind of like what we did at night on the rocks, you know.
God, fun.
So I kind of knew that being in a band wasn't like for me, you know. I didn't have that passion to kind of grind it out and see if I could make it happen, you know, on the road. So I started talking to a few different labels about internships and just kind of stayed persistent about it and interned for Epic. Yeah, in like 2002, 2003 is when I started there, and just slowly climbed up the ropes, you know. I was lucky to work for some guys that really like took me under their wing, and I was willing and ready to just go to as many shows as they wanted me to go to. So I kind of became like the LA scout, and then from there a junior scout, and yeah, just slowly climbed.
So
up the
when
ranks.
You're like scouting a band, it's pretty much like you guys like the music, you need to see them live. You like just will go watch them and kind of like base, I guess. If
critique.
Like,
yeah, because this was way before YouTube. You know, I mean, this was even before MySpace. Initially, it was like MP3.com, Friendster, and oh, Pure man. Volume.
Pure
was
Volume.
Like, Pure Volume was just kind of starting, and I remember like Panic at the Disco being one of the first bands to like kind of pop off of Pure Volume.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was different times for sure. You know,
like, do you even? I mean, I guess you care, but is it like as big of a deal now if a band is good live before you like sign them? Like,
it is to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't seem as critical as it was before.
Yeah.
But YouTube also can tell you a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think more so for me that there are companies that will just send offers to artists kind of sight unseen, you know, after more or less just communicating on the phone. And I'm not going to say I've never done that, but I think it's usually been because we absolutely have had to because of the urgency in the situation. I always like to fly out and meet with the artist or fly them and well, meet with us, because it's like, for me, sure, I can sell myself and what I do, but it's not just me that they're working with.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, I'm a piece of the puzzle, but it's the whole staff.
Right. Well, and
for,
you have
for
to
Epitaph,
like,
you know?
And like, you might not like, you have to like each other. I feel like it's such a, we've had so many different managers and A&Rs and all this stuff. And it's something where it's like, yo, like if you don't like each other, it's a horrible situation. Cause like, yeah, we're not going to want to listen to what your opinions are because we just don't like you. So it's already jaded.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is you were always so good at that, you know, when you were working with us, like we really bonded, like we were homies, like we were in the mix. We could actually have like an honest conversation about music and like that kind of stuff is, it's so important. And I think like younger bands, it's a good thing for them to know, like work with people that like you like as people too. You know what I mean? Because at that point, you're just going to have a better relationship. Like it's going to be easier. It's going to be better. And we've always, you know, when we don't like somebody, we just don't, we're like, all right, we can't do this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Especially at this point, we've been doing it for so long that we're just like, okay.
What was the first band that you had like, you know, scouted or something that was kind of like the first kind of like big step in your career? Like, was there like that moment where like you were like, okay, this is the one, like this is the band? Or
yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, that band Quiet Drive that I mentioned before,
I just love that band. Yeah,
yeah. So when I heard their demo tape, it was like, it reminded me a lot of like early Incubus, like Morning View, and
yeah,
and I was a huge fan of that stuff back in the day, and this was in a time where they were Incubus was still, I mean, they're putting out records now, but they were still kind of riding that.
Yeah, they're like on top.
And that whole kind of sound, new metal, you know, whatever you want to call it, was still pretty prevalent. So I just thought, I instantly fell in love with the music. And then my boss and I flew out to Minneapolis, to where they're from, and saw them. And that was a big moment, because the band was still like a little rough around the edges live because they were so new, but the singer just had this amazing voice and the songwriting was like pretty undeniable. And I remember my boss, I was nervous too for a lot of reasons. I mean,
it's like the first excited. Thing you brought to the
table. Yeah, you're like, yo, yeah,
totally, you know,
I'd be so scared to do that, dude.
Taking like, my boss with me, like shit, you yeah, better kill like, it.
Oh God.
Yeah. I mean, I was barely 21 years old. So yeah.
And like A&R, it's like such a scary position, cause you're, especially in today's like landscape, like you hear about so many guys getting like changed out and all this stuff, especially the major label system. It's like your ass is on the line. Like you're going to sign this band. I mean, especially in those, the big deal situations, it's like, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars on the table. And if the band doesn't perform or something, it's almost as much on you as it is on them.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So that was kind of like the big first pivotal moment for me, you know, signing those guys and having them have that great, you know, show. But yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, everyone's got their stories of like finding bands too that, I mean, there's, I know we passed on the Killers at Epic. You know, we had Mr. Brightside, the song, and it was pretty much as, you know, it's how you hear it today, just a little bit less produced. So the reason why we passed on them was because we thought the music was great, but then they showcased for the label at the Swing House back in Hollywood, and the live show was terrible. So
that's crazy.
Kind of going back to what we were talking about before. Yeah, I think like you have to be careful, because like I always had the mindset that I really wanted to have a band, have all my bands have strong live shows,
right?
Because even if it doesn't take off sales wise, when they come through town and your company goes out to see the band and they see the potential that you saw in them, I mean, I hate to make it about me, but at least as the guy that brought the band in, you don't look like a total.
No, for sure, though. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas like you spend all this money and you go after a band that doesn't have a good live show and they don't sell. And then everyone comes to see the band.
Yeah, you're like,
Did you sign this band?
So this is what we rolled up our sleeves and put all this like sweat equity and elbow grease into. So, yeah.
Well, I mean,
but then the Killers ended up being a great live band, was my point. So you have to be able to, I think that's kind of the key, is to be able to tell, okay, maybe if they don't sound good, like, did these guys have the potential?
Yeah.
You know, try to analyze their musicianship, their skills, their playing ability.
Do you help there? Like, do you, if you sign a young band and they're like, you see them live, you're like, okay, this needs work. Are you like, as an A&R, are you like telling them like, hey, I think we need to like
vocal lessons or,
you know?
Yeah. I feel like that happened a lot more like in the past with my career, with bringing in vocal coaches and stuff like that. I honestly think now like, the competition is so fierce and there's just so much noise, no pun intended, to cut through that. Like, yeah, it's more rare to come in there and actually like have to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I think people are like good now.
No, there's so many. The musicianship has just gotten. I don't know, because YouTube now, you can go look up tutorial how to play a riff. Like, I don't know what it is.
Tony Hawk Pro Skater Factor. I literally call it. It's like there's kids like skateboarding now that grew up playing video games, and when they were little, they were doing these things in video games, and they're like, oh, I'm just gonna go outside and. Like, I'm going to try to do this impossible trick, right? Same with drummers. Like, they grew up listening to programmed drums, and now they're like, oh, I'm just going to sit in my room and learn it until I can do it. And these kids are doing things now that, like, we could have never done, because we grew up listening to Blink-182 and stuff. And yeah, like, those guys are, like, great, but it's like, you can play all the guitar parts in Blink-182, but it's like, if you, you grew up now listening to all this super produced music, so these kids are, like, getting so tight because they're, like, listening to, like, really produced stuff. That's what I think. Anyway.
No, for sure. Cause it has to be like most of the bands that you guys have interest in, like chances are they're probably going to be good live, because there's so much music and there's probably so many artists that's like the best ones are just going to kind of naturally rise to the top, I feel like.
Yeah. And I feel like kids are getting started at a younger and younger age. And, you know, I think, one of the main areas we can help as A&R is, you know, I've found a handful of artists that like are really talented. They've got a good identity, a good message, a good look, but like their songwriting, you know, could just be a lot stronger in some of its aspects. So pairing them with the right producer who's got writing chops as well, you know, or the right songwriters if they're into that kind of thing, that's where we can really add.
Are you seeing that a lot with bands now, like the co-writing thing? Because I feel like it was pretty big when we were doing like our last two records, and I don't know if it's like still as big.
It's not the bands that I work with, it hasn't been
like a big thing.
Yeah, yeah, that common. But it's not to say that it's still not happening. I think it's a lot more of like bringing in the producer that can also bring value to the writing. So it's not so much of like, okay, we're going to sit down in a room with a couple writers. But, you know, I'm working with mainly rock stuff.
Right.
I mean, obviously all different areas of rock, but I think in the pop world, you know, electronic and a lot of the other.
Yeah, a lot of co-writes.
They're doing a lot more of that.
Yeah.
So you're at Epic. You go to Atlantic at a point, right? That's like your next step from Epic?
Yeah, I was at Epic for like 4 years, and then I went to Atlantic in 2007 in New York.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You did. You lived in New York. Yeah. How did you like that, like, landscape as opposed to, like, is it, like, different, like, the New York, like, teams and, like, all that kind of stuff?
I mean, it was just awesome being able to move to New York when I was 25, and I was nervous as hell.
By the way, you had a rent-controlled apartment that I went to, I remember. You were like, yeah, it's not as expensive as it should. It was the sickest apartment. It should have been so crazy expensive, like, right in Manhattan. It was right in Manhattan, right?
Yeah, it was in Chelsea.
Oh, that apartment was sick. I just remember going there. I don't know why.
Yeah, that was a great spot. But I remember, everyone's just a lot more intense. And I don't really know how else to put it other than intense in New York. There's like, people are nice there, but there's just a lot less time for bullshit and small talk. And I grew to like that a lot. But being like a more chilled out, like West Coast, Southern California guy, like
you surf.
Yeah. when I first got to the company, I remember being super just kind of nervous and until I kind of got acclimated and then it ended up being great.
What bands did you work with like during your like Atlantic period?
Mayday Parade was a big one. Circus Survive was another one. This artist Little Boots from England. Kind of in like she was part of that first wave of like female pop artists like in the Ellie Goulding
like the indie
LaRue like kind of before and then Lady Gaga she took off but and then who else and then I worked with the Cab who are on Fueled by Ramen so
that's awesome. So and then you went to Fearless
and I was trying to sign Pierce the Veil actually
to Atlantic. What happened they didn't want to like it didn't work.
You know what? I think as those talks started, my contract was up at Atlantic and I left. And then I was close enough with the management that and I was the one at Atlantic who was passionate about it. So it's like once I left, no one really at the time wanted to raise their hand for that. I mean, they liked the band, but
it was, you were the one that was like championing.
Yeah. And then so getting to Fearless also made a lot more sense to both the band and just in general, like that band was better suited to go to a bigger indie, you know, in my opinion, rather than a major.
For sure.
So
you went to Fearless straight from Atlantic and then like pretty much brought Pierce the Veil in like when you got there.
That was the first signing there.
Yeah.
So
it's a good first signing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
was that the album that had like King for a Day on it and all that? Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that when that came out, it was so funny because we had done so much with Pierce before and like they were always like a really like a good sized band. And then like, that's just, sometimes it's like that one song. And then they went from like, just the biggest, like worldwide, like rock band ever. I feel like that's
the
just craziest so
crazy thing about Pierce to me is they haven't like totally changed up at all. They've stayed pretty much the same band. It just all of a sudden clicked on like a worldwide scale on like album 3, which was like crazy. Cause if you listen to album 1 and 2, it's like, it's pretty much the same. Like it just, it just all of a sudden, like, their grind like just paid off in like a big way.
Yeah, man. I mean, that band, it was just the right natural progression. You know, I mean, the one thing that I can say I helped with was introducing them to Dan Corniff, who ended up producing Collide with the Sky. And I think if you would ask Vic, you know, he would probably attest that was a big part of them going to the next level. But you know, it was timing too. Like they had been like kind of that band that Data Remember had taken out and Bring Me the Horizon and some of these massive bands took out. And I think we're kind of like, maybe not envious, but just really liked the fact that they were kind of playing these more like experimental, kind of longer, non-traditional style songs. So they had developed this like really core fan base, put in this legwork and built a really solid like indie following. And then just, you know, having Kellen be on that song, King for a Day. It was like the perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know? But they really did make that's just a phenomenal record.
Yeah,
it is.
An awesome record. How did you like the major label system? Because we've obviously been in both. The major label system versus like the indie label system, I guess. Like, how is it from that side? Because like as an artist, we obviously know the difference. But like, you know, for anybody who's like thinking or on the fence about the two, like what the pros and cons are, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, so my tastes always lied more in, I guess, like indie music, you know, or just independent style, independent label, you know, music. So I think once the majors shifted away from some of that, it was kind of obvious for me to go work at independent labels.
Right.
But I think, you know, the obvious advantages of a major label are the resources. You know, they have big companies with high paid executives that have, you know, really solid relationships across the board, you know, and for artists that are really aspiring for like that massive mainstream audience, you know, and I'm talking like shooting for the stars, you know, Saturday Night Live performances,
yeah, yeah,
Grammy
yeah.
nominations, all that stuff, which can happen to independent labels, obviously, but it's a lot more common at majors, then that's probably the avenue for you to go to as an artist or try to aspire to. But at the same time, you're also, your competition's way more fierce,
yeah,
way more stiff. You're going up against that many more people, and your shelf life is a lot shorter. And it's like, I've used this analogy before, you get signed to a major label and that hourglass gets turned over, you know, and the amount of sand in that hourglass is usually a lot less than if you were to come to an indie label.
Yeah.
And that's because when we sign bands to Epitaph or, you know, I mean, it's like, we still have to know when we've put in so much work that it's just not working,
right,
you know, for either party, but we're not
you're not as quick to like,
it's not as risky, you
yeah.
know? Yeah. Because we can, you know, kind of be more strategic about it, and the overhead's lower, and we sign less bands,
yeah,
less artists, you know?
Yeah.
So there's not as much bottlenecking going on.
Yeah. You know, it's like, I feel like when you get to the major label sign, it's like, the pressure's on, like you said, it's like the hourglass turns over, the pressure's on, like it's scary. And, yeah. And with the indie, like you were saying, it's, you can kind of build with the artist, that you take a little more time to do this and that, more strategic moves to get to the next step and then the next step, instead of you have to go straight here on the major. You
well,
know
because
what I mean?
The yeah. wins, I feel like the wins are not easier to reach, but the wins are like more realistic, right? So it's like,
yeah,
if you, you know, if the label only spent 10, 15K on like your EP or your record, and then you, you know, sell X amount of records, it's not, you don't have to sell as much to cover that, those expenses, where yeah. it's like when you're at a major, it's like just the single, we went with this like crazy pop producer and it's going to cost 100K for the beat, like just random things. And it's a lot more, it is a lot more pressure. It's like, if this song doesn't get into the top 40, you're fucked. And it's like, all right.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, I could go down the rabbit hole way too far on this, and you know, we can
just like burn every bridge.
No, I just meant like you can analyze this, you know, for days. But,
right.
But essentially, like, if you're an independent artist or new artist and like you're in it for like the long haul, like I feel like taking, at least having the strategy of taking gradual steps to get to that final, you know, goal is a lot, it just works out a lot better because, you know, even if it takes longer to get there, like by the time, like Pierce the Veil, for example, by the time they got to that third record, like even if that record hadn't been the one to really catapult them, they still would have continued to grow, you know, and it could have been the fourth record.
Right.
You know? I mean, I feel like with, like, it's great that there's the streaming platforms that can allow art to be thrown out there by anyone that's making it, you know, it's like, I think that's, it's an amazing thing,
yeah,
you know, for anyone that's creating. But at the same time, there's so much that comes out that even the artists that, let's say, get signed to a major and get all, you know, get the New Music Friday, get the, you know, the hot number one, like just get all the big playlists and get those numbers, you know, really jacked really quick. It's hard to sustain that, you
yeah.
know what I mean? And unless you keep feeding that, it's like once you get to the top, you've got to keep feeding it.
It's also
there.
Really hard to turn that into a fan base. Like we know a lot
totally.
Of people,
They can't sell
they're
tickets.
They're the 25th they can, most yeah. streamed artist in the world, but they cannot sell any tickets. So I think the yeah. one thing I learned, like doing, like, you know, like seeing both sides of it, was like the fan bases at indie labels. I don't know if it was just the music or whatever, but like the fan bases that these bands and these artists had built because they went the slow route, they you know, like whether or not like they ended up selling millions of records or not, they were able to go play anywhere in the world, in the country, you know, whatever. And
the
like
fan loyalty,
and they have fan loyalty.
It's huge. Yeah. And I mean, you guys know, you have to treat yourself like a brand, you
yeah.
know, if you're in it for the long haul.
Exactly.
You know, so
it's oops, no, go for it.
Are you guys, is that so, speaking about playlists and stuff? Like, cause I know before it was like first week numbers, Billboard, all this stuff. Are you guys less focused on those things now and more focused on like streaming and playlists and like, because before it was like, we need to get your song on the front of Target. We need to like, how has that like changed from like when you like worked our, I would say like our Savages was probably like in that era of like the final, like we really yeah. care about hard discs versus like streaming.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not about the first week for us anymore. I mean, with our like top tier acts, you know, like the more like legacy, you know, marquee artists, like we're certainly paying more attention to the first week than we would with other bands. But you also have to remember, like with like pre-orders, that's kind of gone out the window. Like people, they still buy merch, but it's not as like, it's not so immediate. And,
right.
And the demand isn't there for all that stuff week of release with the CDs and all that other stuff. So what you're seeing is like before you'd have that first week and you put up the huge number and then it would drop off the kind of standard like 75-80%. And then get to like a kind of constant like weekly number that you hope to kind of sustain for as long as you can. And then you start planning your next record.
Right.
Or unless something happens, like you get a big sync or a big performance on like late night TV or a radio play or something that can then take it back up. But now what you're seeing is you have like the decent sized first week, but then it drops down, but it doesn't drop down as far, and it stays at the plateau is higher and it stays there for a longer amount of time.
Wow, that's interesting.
So
yeah,
it takes longer to get to those counts, those stream counts and the plays and all that stuff. But you just kind of have to be patient. And I feel like, I don't know, I think it allows for the artist to kind of maintain a more like stable existence.
Yeah. It's an easier to sustain, but with a higher plateau. Like it's, yeah, yeah, that's pretty crazy. I haven't even thought about it that way. That's,
yeah.
Are you seeing it being like more, cause like we're doing like the electronic stuff where it's less album focused, more, it's better to do like a song every 6 weeks kind of thing. Cause it's like yeah. so based on like streaming and DJs and all the stuff. Are you seeing that with bands now?
Totally.
Like we'll do singles instead of putting out an album. Like we'll just put out a song every now and again.
Yeah, more and more we're doing that, whether it's just a single or an EP, you know, 3-song single, 5-song EP. We're definitely trying to space it out. I mean, I think it's harder for the more traditional bands that and the national touring and all that kind of, you know.
Yeah, because you want to do like your album tour.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder to focus on from like a marketing standpoint, mm-hmm. but you know, Falling in Reverse, one of our biggest artists, you know, Ronnie's been dropping, you know, he'll drop like a single and then he'll book dates, you know, and then a couple months later, drop a single, book dates. And he's been extremely successful doing that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen bands do it and I think it's such a smart way to do it. And it's also cost effective because like to go in to record one song is like, it's not that expensive. And you can like make a cool visual for it and like get fans hyped up again.
Yeah.
It's just I guess doing it as a band is just harder because you have to get, you know, 5 guys in a room, like do like the whole thing where like we just literally make our singles on planes on a laptop.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I've seen is like, because even for like big, you know, bands like, you know, some of our biggest acts like Parkway Drive, Thrice, Architects, you know, they could deliver an album that's literally great front to back, and it doesn't matter who you are, but like any band of that status, and chances are when you look at their stream counts and you get to the end of their record, the last few songs, even if they're the best ones on there, they're just going to have less streams.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people
don't want to, and even myself included, like it's a lot harder to sit there and digest a full album's worth of music with all the new albums that come out every week, because I try to like, you know, keep abreast of everything that, not everything, but as much as I can.
And it's so easy to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. So, like on one hand, I think it's changed the playing field for better because it's set the bar higher mm-hmm. for songwriting. So, but that being said, like, I think those bigger bands, at least in the rock space, can still push physical product and sell vinyl. So I think something where like you might drop like a cluster of songs, you know, let's say for example, 3 songs, you know, 1 month, and then wait a few months and drop another 3, and then wait a few months, drop another 3, and at the end kind of culminate that into a physical product.
When you guys are doing that,
one way to do
it. I was going to say, when you guys are doing that, are you sending the band in to like record an album and then spacing out the release? Or are you sending in the band to like just record a song or two, send them back in to record a song or two? Is it different for every band? Or?
It's different. It's a lot easier if they can record 15 songs at once.
Right.
And then
spread it out,
pepper them out. Yeah. I mean, that's what we shoot for. But then, as you guys know all too well, you're artists, like, and I don't blame you. Let's say you recorded 15 songs today, and then in a year from now, that last batch of those 15 are going to come out. You're probably going to be like, oh, like,
yeah,
fuck, we could beat those.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, it's,
yeah,
you, or you're just going to, even if they're great, and even if the label's telling you great, they're still really old to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're so old.
Because they're your songs and you've been sitting on them for a while.
Yeah.
I totally get that, but it's our job a lot of times to.
Well, and that can, you know, that's like where the good relationship comes into play, where it's like, yeah, like, yeah, we know this is a good move. And it's like, you know, it's kind of the same thing as having like demo-itis. You know what I mean? When artists are like, no, the scratch demo vocal I did in my room is way better than this great sounding album.
Like,
you know,
no, it's not, Keith.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And it's funny. I mean, there's been more than one instance where it's like the artist records 12 songs or whatever, and, they're going to make an 11 song album, and that one song they want to leave off is the one that the label loves.
Like, what do you do? Yeah. So what do you do?
Yeah. How does that situation work?
Yeah.
Out?
What do you do in that position? Like, actually, what do you do just as a landscape? Like when you want to tell the artist something, like how do you approach that? Cause it's somebody's like art, and then you're coming at it, you know, yeah, as an outside perspective. And luckily, like we actually like had a conversation a long time ago where we like decided like, you know, we're going to like listen, like we're going to like trust opinions, and we're going to do stuff because our opinions might not always be right. And it's always a good like tiebreaker because there's two of us. But how do you like approach a band to be like, you're pretty much wrong and you should do this? Or,
well, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I would never do that.
Yeah. No, but I think, first of all, it's like back to kind of what you guys were saying about you want to make sure you like the artists and you get along with them from the get go. We try to make sure that, you know, if we're going into something and from the first stages, we can tell they're like extremely hard headed and not really like open minded, like chances are it's just going to cause an ugly situation down the road. But so I guess building up to any like specific creative conversation, I try to just build up my own credibility with the artist so that when it comes time to have those objective talks that I can kind of approach it as delicately as I can. But I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's ended not pretty a couple times, you know? I mean, it's mended itself, but it's not the most fun conversation to have, you know? Because it's my opinion versus their opinion.
Right.
And
they made it. So it's like, it's tough. Like to,
yeah.
Yeah.
And usually the producers, even if they have an opinion one way or the other, they just kind of like
stay out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. They stay in the,
well, because you
zone.
Guys are like paying them and they're like best friends with the band. It's such a weird place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But I think like without ganging up on the artist, there's ways of having sidebar conversations with management and you know, Brett, specifically at Epitaph, you know, our CEO is very hands on when it comes to that kind of stuff, and he's a producer, mixer, songwriter himself. So that helps me a lot because
he's in Bad Religion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's founding member.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The owner, he's the owner of Epitaph, yep. Right? Yeah, he was in Bad Religion also, yeah.
Yeah, and he's written, you know, half of all the, you know, more than half of all their songs. So, you know, that certainly helps having someone on my side that can convey this stuff to the artist too, that's had a success story with songwriting.
But yeah. Well, that gives a lot more credit. It's like when that guy's coming talking to you, you're like, okay, let's open ourselves up
he
a little
knows
bit.
What
like,
he's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've got, you know, 15 years under my belt of signing and working with artists.
Of course.
So,
yeah. You have the same thing.
But you know, it's every conversation, every situation's different.
Did you, I don't know if you said this yet, but did you go to like any sort of like college or anything for the A&R job, or just after playing in bands, just got the internship?
Yeah, I just got the internship.
It's interesting because we've had some people on here, like managers that have gone to like music managing and then people that haven't. So I just always find that interesting, like for kids that are listening, if they have to go to school for something like that, or like they just get in the right positions, like it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously didn't go to school for that specific thing and it worked out for me.
Yeah.
But I know people as well that went to school for it.
But it's not a requirement, right? Like you don't have to have a degree.
No. Yeah. It's not a requirement. If I could go back in time, instead of getting a communications degree, I would have tried to study more like record engineering and stuff, just for my own knowledge. Not that I'd want to be an engineer.
Yeah. So you could go straight from high school to an internship and just work your way up and never even go to college and still, don't go to college, kids.
I think it's the same in a lot of entertainment in general.
Yeah.
Like the trades, you know, people that get into film usually end up being like a PA and, you know, the equivalent to being an intern in music.
Do you guys, when you're like talking, we're like nearing the end, but when you guys are like talking to a band or talking to somebody, like is it different for every band, but do you talk to the bands mostly directly or do you usually talk like through a manager or with a manager? Like how does it like work? Like your relationships like with bands, like does the band usually talk straight to the A&R? Are you usually talking to like a manager to the band or just everybody at once?
You know, that's a good question too. Again, like, sorry, I keep saying this, but it's just a case by case.
Yeah.
Some artists, and I prefer to be able to have both a dialogue with, you know, both a, you know, a straight dialogue with the manager and then be able to go directly to the artist when needed. Some managers just prefer that things go through them, which is fine too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it can still, stuff can still get done, you know, communication can still exist. But I feel like it's kind of nice to be able to go directly to the artist.
You know? Helps you build like a,
We touched on earlier, like you build that bond with the artist and it's like there's so much more trust in that in that relationship, so it works out when it's discussing what's the single going to be. It's like, all right, we're just going to go talk to our homie, like he's like another member of our band, you know what I mean? Like that's super important.
But you know, I will say too, like there's a handful of artists I work with that if I went in my phone right now, I don't have their direct numbers,
right?
You know, but we have great relationships, you know, and when I sit down with them in a green room or at a lunch or whatever, it's like, it's very positive. It's just a good vibe. But the manager just kind of delegates the official, you know, communication.
Yeah. I guess there's no right or wrong way.
Every case different.
Yeah.
But there definitely has to be a relationship, you know,
not know them. Like,
if there's no, you know, face-to-face interaction, no direct interaction, it all goes through the manager and you know,
you guys have to love, I mean, you have to, if you're championing a band, like you have to love the guys, I feel like, because it's like, you guys are investing so much time and resources into them. Like you have to want them to succeed as people, I feel like.
Yeah. And it all depends. I mean, some managers are like really all about like the business and like they'll even admit that. And so when it comes to creative, they're like, all right, I'm going to step back. I'm going to let you dive in with the band. And that's cool. And some managers are really valuable on the creative side, you know, too. It just kind of depends.
Cool.
Your own path.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We filled up the time. Thank you for stopping by.
First of all, it was good to see you, man. It's been a long time. And we haven't really mentioned, we used to work together a lot on two different albums. And so, it's good to see you, man.
You too, man.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.